This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield. You can't not start with the tallest building in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, the old headquarters for United States Steel. It's a black monolith, symbol and fortress of industrial power, soaring in the now pristine Pittsburgh sky above the confluence of three mighty rivers. But its vista has changed. Gone is the golden sulfurous haze, gone are the belching smokestacks, blazing furnaces, and slag-lined river valleys snaking along the Appalachian foothills. The industry that sustained a region, girded the world's infrastructure, and underwrote a now vanished way of life has long since crossed oceans.
These are unemployed and laid-off steelworkers in the Monongahela Valley, the area around Pittsburgh that was the birthplace of American steel. These workers are angry because they are losing their place in the American dream.
Decades into this new Pittsburgh, the vanished economic sector, the vanished mill jobs, and the vanished industrial working class persist in the American imagination. Back in March, Joe Biden used a Pittsburgh labor hall as a backdrop for his infrastructure plan and its good union jobs. And then again in his address to Congress.
Look, think about it. There is simply no reason why the blades for wind turbines can't be built in Pittsburgh instead of Beijing. No reason.
Donald Trump, who lied to the coal belt about reviving the moribund mining industry, used the city to define what America First is all about. Pittsburgh, not Paris. And when John Kerry stumped here in 2004, he invoked Depression-era poet Langston Hughes.
He said, "Let America be America again. Let it be the dream that it used to be. For those whose sweat and blood, whose faith and pain, for those whose hand at the foundry, something Pittsburgh knows about, for those whose plow in the rain must bring back our mighty dream again."
But they were all seeing ghosts. Steel City is now Healthcare City, representing almost one in four jobs in the region. Some 92,000 of them work for just one employer, the sprawling, omnivorous University of Pittsburgh Medical Center, UPMC, whose logo now adorns the black skyscraper sentinel of the Three Rivers. But this is not just a case of a clean economy displacing a filthy one. To historian Gabriel Winant, author of The Next Shift, The Fall of Industry and the Rise of Healthcare in Rust Belt America, the story of economic transformation in Pittsburgh is the story of disparity of wealth, income, and political power that did not vanish when the smokestacks came down. As we shall see, it was a metamorphosis that has so marginalized those 92,000 hospital workers that their employer has claimed they're not employees at all. Ghosts, too, it turns out. In this hour, we'll explore with Winant how the saga of two Pittsburghs reveals in grim detail how America has strayed so perversely far from its founding promise. Gabe, welcome to On the Media.
Thanks for having me. Nice to be here.
We're going to approach this as a story in three acts, beginning with steel. It was an industry built on minerals like iron ore, limestone, and coal, and hard labor. Folklore celebrates a hardy Croat named Joe Magarac, whose last name translates to jackass in Croatian, and who, the story goes, only knows how to work and to eat like a donkey.
sitting out of my hand. But the blasted furnace couldn't get enough, so I jumped on it. I made that up to Mighty Joe, Mighty Joe.
What was the work like?
I mean, the absolute first thing you have to say is it was hot. It was dangerous. It was filthy.
One of the guys came up and took his goggles off, and the skin came off with it because it was so hot.
When you'd come out of that thing, hey, completely dirty, just like a coal miner, and the stuff had gotten all into my skin, all around my privates and everything like that, it got in, and I had to go to the doctor because it was just peeling, you know. Oh, it was a hell of a thing.
One of my friends died here recently from the inches that he got when a whole sheet of iron fell on him from a crane and crippled him for life.
Yeah, you know, I quote a memoir in the book written by a steelworker who describes trying to understand what was under the mill's rusty sheet iron skirts that caused our house to rattle and shake. Why did the old men in the neighborhood curse and worship it? The cursing and the worshiping together is a window into how profoundly industrial work shaped this whole world.
Many steelworkers were able to establish solidly middle-class lifestyles. What was the evolution that got them there?
The turning point really comes during the New Deal.
In 1936, the men and women in these industries made up their minds to do something about their deplorable conditions. They built the most powerful union of all time, the United Steelworkers of America.
They leveraged these employers again and again in these strikes in 46, 49, 52, 54, 56, and 59.
The sixth major shutdown since World War II.
The steelworkers were powerful enough that they could make themselves a problem for the president.
President Eisenhower expressed weariness at the unbending attitude of both sides.
I'm not going to try to assess any blame, but I'm getting sick and tired of the apparent impasse in the settlement of this matter.
Every steel industry strike in those years got settled in the White House.
A solution had been found in America's number one labor crisis. Production was resumed on the basis of a wage increase of 18.5 cents an hour, offset by a price increase of $5 a ton.
You write about one of history's little noticed policy decisions directly related to steelworkers' fringe benefits, the public-private welfare state. What does that mean?
It was thought during the New Deal that eventually they would be able to establish what we would today call Medicare for all. Harry Truman didn't succeed in doing that. And instead, the unions that had been agitating for that decided, you know what, let's just get the employer, whether it's GM or U.S. Steel, to provide a plan through the private sector. This is really where the idea that you get your health insurance from your job comes from. And over the course of the 50s, collectively bargained health insurance spreads really rapidly across the working class.
Healthcare was a life-changing benefit for steelworkers and eventually millions of other employees around the country. A Western Pennsylvania academic named Jack Metzger was moved to write, quote, "If what we lived through in the 1950s was not liberation, then liberation never happens in real human lives."
Wages were going up year after year. They would have these strikes and they would win. They had defined benefit pensions in a way that we don't have now. They had this health plan that got better and better. You couldn't imagine how few dollars steelworkers and their families had to put toward their health care. By 1959, steelworkers didn't even have to contribute to the premium. They also had power on the job itself. The 1959 strike was fought over the question of whether or not managers could just change job assignments arbitrarily. And they couldn't. I mean, this was written into the contract. Management could change the equipment, and then they could reassign people if they did that. But they couldn't just say, you know what? Two of you are doing this job that four of you used to do. That wasn't allowed. And again, that's hard to imagine today.
In the post-World War II period, the American steel economy was essentially a global steel economy, a de facto cartel that for decades didn't need modernization or manufacturing efficiency to prosper. It just raised prices. Management and labor fed at the same trough with ultimately disastrous consequences. Meantime, though, you write, a whole social order had developed around single male, mostly white breadwinners.
The way that you get access to these benefits is either you get a job as a steelworker, if it's Pittsburgh, or you make yourself the legal dependent of a steelworker, which is to say, be his wife or be his kid. This creates these kind of stratified layers of who is in on this golden age and who's not in on it, and what you have to do to be in on it. There are people who don't have such an easy time getting jobs as steelworkers. That's racialized. And there are people who have to kind of put up with what their husbands say, because their husband is how they have access to all of this. So a system that's supposed to deliver broad-based prosperity, but is that internally divided, was a really unstable configuration.
So who or what was the arbiter of all that?
Well, ultimately, the mill is the arbiter, right? The mill is the reason these people are here. It's the reason their parents or their grandparents came to Pittsburgh. It's what's giving them access to wages, benefits, all of this. Ultimately, the household and the family are subordinate to it.
And in these mill towns, you say, lives were hypergendered and also racialized.
Men were heavily overrepresented and women underrepresented in waged work in Pittsburgh, even compared to the 1950s norm. Now, that didn't mean women weren't working. The kinds of work that they did happened more outside of the money economy. Now, that was true for white folks. For African Americans, even this kind of tenuous security that white people had, African Americans really couldn't hang on to it much at all. And that meant that African American women had to bring in wages at much higher rates than white women did, already starting in the 50s and 60s, and then that kind of goes up over time. And, you know, going back all the way to the New Deal itself, domestic work, which was obviously heavily assigned to women, was not regulated by labor law. And from the 40s onward, healthcare work also was not protected by labor law or minimum wage or hours regulations. And so when women do have to go get these kinds of jobs, they are exiting the protected circle of the New Deal state that their husbands work in. It's like they're going into a different country.
The racialized structures in the mills were a sort of informal but nonetheless omnipresent Jim Crow.
Come to go to job, they were separated. Whites went to the good jobs, blacks went to the lowest class job.
All the craft jobs and the high paying jobs were white folks. See, the black folks had all the dirty jobs.
That a white man would come in and you'd have to train him. The next 2 weeks, he your boss.
In steel, and this was common in a lot of big industries in this time, seniority, which rules everything in a unionized factory, was determined at the level of the department rather than the whole factory. Even if you were accumulating seniority, you were a long-term employee, you were unlikely to be able to change what part of the plant you worked in. And so that created these racialized traps. In the blast furnace, which was a hot and dirty and hard job, in the open hearth, which is a hot and dirty and hard job, and worst of all, in the coke ovens, where they baked coal to turn it into fuel, was disproportionately work that was assigned to African Americans. And also, you know, African American workers, because they couldn't get out of these undesirable departments, when there is a cyclical downturn, they would be the first out and the last to be hired back in.
And if I understand your book correctly, the unions were complicit in this.
Absolutely. So organizations like the UAW or the United Steelworkers or the United Mine Workers would accept African-American members and sometimes embrace them. They supported civil rights nationally at the political level, but they didn't really want to disrupt this small-scale pattern within the plant of who got the good jobs and who didn't get the good jobs. White men who had the good jobs more or less wanted to be able to pass them down to their sons. They certainly didn't want the integration of the seniority lines. And there weren't really enough African-Americans inside the union to disrupt that politically so straightforwardly.
We discussed earlier how the cartel's grip on the global market created a spiral of higher wages and higher prices and higher wages and so on. Isn't that more or less the definition of an inflationary cycle?
Yeah. So if you're going to organize working class prosperity through attaching large groups of workers to big kind of monopoly employers, then this is a risk that you're going to run into. And already in the late 50s, you see this strange thing happen where inflation is starting to go up and at the same time unemployment is starting to go up. And those two things are supposed to be opposites. It's supposed to be you get one or the other. Now, we would know that phenomenon in the 70s later as stagflation, right? It came back in a big way. But it's a kind of intrinsic feature of the New Deal state, the public-private welfare system, and these big industrial corporations that were its private sector component. This is a structural fault in that system.
Meantime, another kind of inflationary phenomenon, steelworker families really leaned into healthcare. Now, the work was taxing, as you've said, and dangerous, and the environment was foul. But does that entirely explain the medical gold rush of the 50s, 60s, and 70s?
No, it doesn't. So there's a couple key things. First of all, I think it's actually hard to overstate how significant it was for people who, you know, did backbreaking work all day long, felt cast off and looked down on and treated like mules in different ways, that they could go to this kind of modern house of science that is the hospital and, you know, have someone pay attention to them and take care of them. You know, in an effort to reduce healthcare use, one hospital does an experiment of trying to enroll people in getting mental health services, you know, some kind of therapy, and seeing does that affect how much they use the rest of the healthcare system? And the answer is yes, actually. So there's reason to see the healthcare system as a whole doing a kind of social work for this population. But it's also important to say steel workers were at their most numerous at the time of the Korean War, and their numbers diminish steadily after that. What that means is that young men have a harder and harder time getting into the industry because of the seniority system. Therefore, the workforce is getting older over these decades. And so you have these people who have this really good insurance, who are increasingly an elderly population, have these social needs and have these health needs. And that drives very intense use of the healthcare system. In 1979, at the kind of end of this cycle, the Pittsburgh region generated 1.6 inpatient days in the hospital per capita that year. That's about triple our national rate today.
So all these seeds have been planted in the economy and the culture, from healthcare consumption to fiscal policy to racial segregation to the devaluation of non-industrial labor to the patriarchy, which seeds maybe didn't fully germinate till the steel economy began to erode. How did it look, the beginning of the end?
Well, you know, at first, it didn't look like anything much. The union president would look at the numbers and he would say, you know, gee, there are 50,000 fewer steel workers this year than there were 5 years ago. But it wasn't for quite a long time that people started to realize something profound is changing and has already changed.
Denial ran high. But then, in September 1977, just across the border in Ohio, it all began to accelerate.
In Youngstown and nearby Campbell, they have a name for the day disaster struck. They call it Black Monday.
It's hard to believe this is happening. After working here for so many years, it's hard to believe that we're put out on the street and don't know what we're going to do.
So between 1977 and about 1986, millions of industrial jobs are lost in places like Youngstown or like Pittsburgh.
The U.S. Steel Corporation announced today that it will close all or part of more than 20 of its plants in Cleveland, in Elmira, New York, Trenton, New Jersey, and three towns in Pennsylvania, Johnstown, Schiffler, and Ambridge.
There's basically a kind of localized Great Depression that happens. I mean, unemployment rates rise up to near 20%. Whole communities are devastated really profoundly in a very short period of time.
People are losing homes. The American dream has been turned into the American nightmares with job loss, families breaking up, and suicides.
The population, which has been already aging and also shrinking as the young leave, that speeds up really intensely. There are increases in homelessness. In a couple of these steel mill towns, suicide rates double. Depression rates, alcoholism, domestic violence, all of these kinds of indicators of social distress are increasing really rapidly.
In 1983, President Ronald Reagan offered some choice words of consolation.
How could the major employer in the town, the very lifeblood of the town, close its gates and lock its doors? This was as inconceivable as the town itself closing down. But we know the plant can close, no matter how essential it is to the employees and the townspeople. We know that America's economic strengths change and grow in different directions, sometimes without regard to the people who serve the old industries. This is called the free market, and it's what gives our children and their children an economic future.
You know, Reagan's message to the steelworkers was always learn to code, basically. You know, keep up. The question of whether or not the steel mills could have been kept open, should have been kept open, we could debate that. We could argue about whether there was another path. But what I don't think we could really say is that it had to go in such a harmful and injurious way for the people who were displaced from this industry, right? That they had to be thrown to the wolves.
Coming up, from the ashes rises healthcare. This is On the Media.
Well, I went down to the steel mill.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.